Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Arvin, registration number 39020, representing Mr. Robert Landon. Today I plan on discussing the first issue raised in Mr. Landon's briefs, that is the issue concerning the trial court's rejection of Mr. Landon's choice of evils defense. I do not plan on discussing the reasonable suspicion issue. However, if this court has any questions concerning that issue, I will be happy to take those questions. The trial court reversibly erred in denying Mr. Landon's affirmative defense of choice of evils because Mr. Landon's offer of proof was sufficient to support that defense. The trial court failed to correctly apply the appropriate standard of review to Mr. Landon's offer of proof and denied the defense, thereby improperly denying Mr. Landon an opportunity to have his defense considered by the jury.
Now, this was originally done in a pretrial proceeding.
That's correct.
Does the statute require that?
The statute just requires that, my understanding of the statute is that it requires that the court resolve whether or not this is a viable defense before evidence of the defense is submitted to the jury. So in other words, before the defendant presents his defense.
So you're not only precluded as a result of the court's ruling from presenting evidence, you're obviously because of no evidence got no instruction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
The appropriate standard of review in considering the sufficiency of an offer of proof in a matter like this consists of two prongs. First, the court must consider the offer of proof in the light most favorable to the defendant. In doing so, a court should assume that the facts alleged in the defendant's offer of proof are true and draw all reasonable inferences therefrom. And reasonable inferences drawn from the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant. Of course, if the trial court submits an affirmative defense to the jury, then the jury is permitted to infer the evidence against the defendant, and the prosecution can argue that the jury should do so. However, for purposes of merely determining whether a court should submit an affirmative defense to the jury in the first place, the facts must be construed in a light that favors the defendant. The second prong, To sufficiently support an offer of proof for a choice of evils defense, the defendant need only introduce just a scintilla of evidence. Put differently, this means merely some credible evidence should be introduced. These standards, taken with the facts alleged in Mr. Landon's offer of proof, reveal that Mr. Landon's offer of proof was sufficient. To that end, I will briefly review the facts that Mr. Landon alleged in his offer of proof. First, before Mr. Landon drove the vehicle in this case, he was attacked by his wife and sustained injury. As I mentioned earlier, this assertion must be taken as true for purposes of the affirmative defense. However, it is worth noting that three facts corroborating this claim were available to the trial court when it issued its order. First, upon interacting with Mr. Landon immediately after the incident, Deputy West observed bite marks on Mr. Landon's arm. Second, Deputy Powers said that when Mr. Landon was arrested, he commented that his wife should be arrested for the domestic, presumably referring to a domestic violence situation. Third, Mr. Landon's wife herself exhibited no red marks or swelling. The second fact alleged in the offer of proof was this. Mr. Landon
called to the police?
No, according to the offer of proof, he did not have a cell phone.
He did not?
He did not, no.
She made the call?
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
I was asking who made the call.
My understanding is that Mrs. Landon, Mr. Landon's wife, made the call.
Okay.
The second fact was that Mr. Landon could not have simply walked away from the incident because he was camping in a mountain area. It was March, and due to the cold weather, he risked hypothermia.
What was the evidence of temperature in the offer of proof or even at the hearing?
The evidence, there is no specific evidence concerning temperature in the offer of proof.
So how do we know it was cold?
Well, like I said, Your Honor, that wasn't established, but for the purposes of determining whether or not the offer of proof is sufficient.
But what I'm saying, if there was no offer of proof regarding temperature, what do we base it on?
Well, the offer of proof stated that it was so cold that Mr. Landon could have suffered from hypothermia. So taking that to be true, then I would submit that that supports that proposition.
That's a conclusion, that's not a fact. The offer of proof would have to say a fact. It was 20 below zero, zero.
Well, the offer of proof.
The fact that it was March, I don't think has anything to do with the temperature, does it?
Of course, the temperature could vary depending on the month. But the, like I said, the offer of proof, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
The offer of proof states that it was cold enough that Mr. Landon could have suffered from hypothermia. If we look at this from the light most favorable to the defendant, taking all assertions to be true, then I would submit that that is sufficient. The mere allegation that Mr. Landon would have suffered from hypothermia because of the cold. Of course, later on in trial, had this defense, had the jury been permitted to consider this defense, the defendant could have submitted more detailed evidence concerning the temperature that night. But I would submit that for purposes of the offer of proof, that allegation alone was sufficient. The third assertion in the offer of proof, as I mentioned, was that Mr. Landon did not have a cell phone, so he could not have called the police. And finally, in order to protect himself from his wife, Mr. Landon had to drive away.
The court seemed to base its ruling in, to some extent, if not considerable extent, on the conclusion that he could have gone to a neighboring campsite, he could have locked himself in the truck and protected himself from the wife. Mm-hmm. These are alternative courses he might have taken. Is that appropriate for the trial court to consider, or is that something the jury can consider?
That is something for the jury to consider, Your Honor. In this case, it was not established that these reasonable alternatives that the trial court based its conclusions on existed. There was some evidence. There was evidence that there were campers somewhere in the campground. However, it was not established that those campers were close enough to Mr. Landon that they could have rendered him any assistance. It wasn't even established that Mr. Landon was aware of these other campers' presence in the campground. So taking this fact in the light most favorable to Mr. Landon, we simply can't reach the conclusion that this was a reasonable alternative for Mr. Landon to pursue.
Didn't he have the burden of coming forward? I mean, that an element of the defense, as I understand it, is that there's no other potential and reasonable, viable alternatives. Wasn't it therefore his burden to at least come forward with an offer of proof or an allegation that there were no such alternatives?
I think Mr. Landon's, he did have the burden, that is correct, but I think his burden as it relates to reasonable alternatives, such as the possibility of other campers in the campground, such as the speculation that he could have locked the doors of his vehicle, I think that burden only arises if it's established that those reasonable alternatives exist, and that simply wasn't established in this case. Taking the facts that we have, that the trial court had at the time of its order, in the light most favorable to Mr. Landon, it wasn't established that Mr. Landon could have obtained help from other campers in the campground, nor is it established that the vehicle that was somewhere near wherever this incident occurred would have provided adequate shelter to protect him from his wife.
Well, the Fontes opinion says a defendant who seeks to assert a choice of evils defense must offer evidence or show through an offer of proof that the conduct at issue did not exceed that reasonably necessary to avoid the pending injury. So the judge focusing on sitting in the truck seems to me to be right at the issue. He's driving away clearly intoxicated. And the judge seemed to say, well, why didn't you just lock the truck? I mean, I think that was his burden, as you indicate, and why was that not on point with us?
You know, and if we were looking at this from a completely objective standpoint, I think the trial court would have correctly come to that conclusion, but we're not. We're looking at this in a light most favorable to Mr. Landon. And here we have a record where all we know is that there was a truck. We don't know that the truck had functional locks. We don't wasn't established that the truck might not have had a window that could easily be removed. We just don't know that it would have provided adequate shelter.
Shouldn't he have said that? Shouldn't he have said, I couldn't go into my car because the latch didn't work?
I mean, that was my point. The defendant has to point out that there's nothing more reasonable than driving away when he's that intoxicated.
I would agree with you if there had been evidence on the record that the truck would provide adequate shelter. And again, looking at this in a totally objective, from a totally objective viewpoint, I could concur with that conclusion. However, looking at it in the light most favorable to Mr. Landon, where there is not clear evidence in the record that the truck provides adequate shelter, I think if we are going to draw any inferences from the facts before us, we have to draw an inference that the truck did not provide adequate shelter.
But it would provide shelter from a cold March evening.
Well, we don't know that either. We don't know that the truck had a working heating system. We don't know how much gas the truck.
What was stated in the offer of proof?
What was stated in the offer of proof was that he had to walk, was that he had to drive away to avoid
hypothermia if he didn't get in the truck. So presumably the truck protected him from hypothermia.
Perhaps he was driving the truck merely to reach a warm place. If the truck didn't have heating, he could have driven it to reach a warm place before he suffered.
This park is in the mountains?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes.
It's called the Rocky Mountains. And so they're probably, if wife really wanted to get to him in the truck, there were ways of breaking the glass and getting in the truck. I mean, living in and surrounded by rocks, that will do that. And I'm not suggesting that that was a probability, but it's a possibility.
It is a possibility, Your Honor. And I would suggest that this sort of speculation that we're engaging in is really appropriate for the jury. I mean, this gets to the heart of the trial court's error here. It was not the trial court's job to look at these facts and draw inferences from where the evidence was ambiguous. That was the job of the jury after the evidence had been submitted to the jury. Unless this court has any further questions, I reserve the remainder of my time.
You have about 2 3/4 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is John Seidel, bar number 17633, representing the people. I think what we can agree on some things. The opposing counsel said we have to take a defendant's offer of proof as true. And we did take his offers in the answer brief. We actually said, even assuming his allegations were true, and we make reasonable inferences in his favor. And I think doing those two things, there was a scintilla of evidence that he showed signs of an injury on his arm, that he did say his wife ought to be arrested, and that the wife showed no signs of injury. But those are the only things we have a scintilla of evidence of. I'm not up here saying that there was no scintilla of evidence on some things that he needed to make an offer of proof on. But his offer failed because he didn't present a scintilla of evidence on enough things to get past the statutory requirement that the judge evaluate the defense as a matter of law. He didn't, for example, show a risk of an imminent, specific, and definite grave injury. And if you look at his reply brief, for example, at page 2, he says, and I'm not going to quote, I'm going to paraphrase, but he says the defendant reasonably feared that his wife would, quote unquote, injure him further. We don't know what that means. A slap? Could be. Now, there was some discussion. My next point is that he omitted evidence that their other alternatives weren't available to him. As we know, that is one of the requirements of this defense. Now, the trial court said in response to the offer, well, gee, you could have contacted nearby campers for help. you could have locked yourself in your trunk, a truck. And I believe, as all three of your honors pointed out, it was the defendant's burden to eliminate those possibilities. It's one thing to say, well, gee, we don't have evidence of that. But when the trial court says, in response to an offer of proof, what about possibilities A, B, and C, it seems to me it's then incumbent upon the defendant to say, well, A, B, and C weren't possible because. That's what we did not have here. When the trial court said, why didn't you go to a different campsite? I don't believe there was an answer to that question. What about locking yourself in the truck, but not starting it and driving away? No answer to that question. Now, there was some discussion about, well, could you just walk away? The offer of proof says, there's a sentence in there that says, well, it was too cold and the defendant would have suffered hypothermia. In my mind, I think Your Honor Judge Furman pointed out, and I think rightfully so, well, that's an inference. Had he said it was 0 degrees, that'd be one thing. But the statute does not require, and none of the case law requires, the trial judge to take all of the inferences that defendant has drawn as true. It requires the trial court to make inferences, reasonable inferences, from the evidence, from the facts, in defendant's favor. And in this business with walking away and hypothermia, the defendant drew the inference without giving any supporting facts in the offer. I think the trial court properly rejected that. And as Your Honors pointed out, I believe Judge Miller did it first, but I think we're all on the same page, it was the defendant's burden, once the trial court made these suggestions, to say, oh no, these weren't possible, let me tell you why. Here's the evidence I will produce. If we don't reach that conclusion, we are really opening up this defense to abuse. Because at that point, if the defendant doesn't make an offer of proof, and we say the judge in this case erred in not allowing the defense to go to the jury, you're essentially saying juries must decide these defenses, even though the judge doesn't know what evidence is going to be brought in. And so then the trial becomes essentially a circus. Well, the defendant brings in evidence that the judge, of all kinds of evidence that the judge has never heard before.
Let me ask you this, going back to the question I asked your opposing counsel. The court in its order found that these other alternatives were available, as I recall the order, that he could have locked himself in the truck, that he could have walked to another campsite. And there seems to me there was a third one that was perhaps even more elegant. Isn't he then making findings and taking away the inference most favorable to the defendant, sort of akin to the on a motion to dismiss at the end of the people's case, where the same standard applies? We give all inferences, everything favorable to the people on the record that's there, and the judge says, I think there's self-defense, so I'm throwing the case out at halftime. Didn't he, in fact, I mean, isn't the defendant entitled to go to the jury with those issues?
Well, let me think now. It sounds like I'm not sure I understand the question, but.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but he's saying, I was in danger. This was my only out. I took it. It was to drive. And the court is finding that other outs existed without the evidence that those outs existed. And contrary to the inferences, as I understand the inference, that were to give the evidence and the offer of proof.
Oh, I see. Maybe I understand a little better now. As I understood the order and what led up to it, I read the court as saying, well, what about this? Couldn't you have gone to another campsite? And also, couldn't you have locked yourself in the truck? Maybe there was a third one. Maybe you could have walked for help. I don't recall. But those are the two I have in my notes. But for our purposes, even one of them is sufficient. What I read the court as doing is saying, here's a possibility I've thought of. Now, at that point, had that, it seems to me it was incumbent upon, to me, that's not a finding of fact yet. To me, it was incumbent upon the defense to say, well, wait a minute, you know, you're wrong about that, Judge, and let me explain what evidence we have to eliminate that alternative. If the defense had done that, and then the trial court said, okay, your evidence isn't good enough, we'd have a much closer case than we have here. The way I read the record is the trial court made some suggestions, two of them as reasonable alternatives. The defense did not disagree with that assessment. Here are two reasonable possibilities. The defense didn't ever disagree and say, no, those aren't reasonable, nor did it say they are not reasonable, and here are facts to tell you why. As I read the situation now, defendant is now at the appellate level coming back and saying, well, now let me tell you why those suggestions aren't reasonable. Well, he can't do that now. The time to do that was at the trial court level. That's the first problem. What he's doing now wasn't done at a timely manner. And second of all, what he's doing now isn't offering facts from which we can draw positive inferences in his favor. He's simply, he's still to this day saying, even now, he's saying, well, we just don't have any evidence that those other alternatives existed or were reasonable. Well, when the trial court says, here's a possibility, did you think of that, and the defense doesn't have a response, and the trial court then puts it in its order saying, well, here's one thing I suggested, and they don't have a response to it, that is the situation we have here. Maybe at that point it becomes a finding of fact, but it's already because the defense hasn't offered the proof that it was given a chance to offer. So I think that's how we distinguish your hypothetical from this case.
Are you aware of any cases that assert a choice of evils defense by driving intoxicated? That was the, that there's nothing that exceeds that? I mean, this is a driving intoxicated case.
I'm not aware of any. I would say that if we were to say that the offer of proof here was sufficient, we are going to get a slew of DUI cases going to trial because people will say, I was afraid I'd be injured in a fight with my spouse, with my brother, with Thanksgiving company, because that's all we have. I was afraid I'd be injured and I didn't want to go out in the cold. So am I saying that there are no circumstances in which driving drunk could be justified under the choice of evils? No, I'm not. I'm just saying I don't know of any cases where it's ever been used, and I'm saying that on this offer of proof, I think it would be very unwise to say that the defense should have gone to the jury on the offer that's made here.
Well, I don't think I'm suggesting, or nor am I arguing it goes to the jury. The question is whether he gets to put on the defense at this stage of the process.
Well, that's a good point, and I'm not sure, and I could be totally off on this, but my recollection is that the trial court did not say, you may never present evidence of this. It just said, and maybe my recollection, my notes of the record, which are not perfect, but my recollection is that there was an offer of proof, it was discussed, and there was a trial court saying, here are some possibilities, you don't have any answers to those. I don't know that the ruling said you don't bother putting on evidence, because there was evidence. It came in through the officers, but there was some evidence that was introduced at trial. I don't think he asked for an instruction on the matter. And so one could arguably ask, well, gee, you know, could he have renewed his motion based on what appeared at trial? We didn't make that argument in the brief, but it's something to consider. I don't want to go too far on this because my memory of the record just isn't good enough, but I do think that there's a difference between saying, right now your offer of proof isn't good enough and I'm not going to allow you to present any evidence, and then let's later determine whether or not you go to the jury. I think there's a distinction there. If there's no more questions on that point, I think I have said what I wanted to say on that, and so I will.
Can I ask you a question about the...
Oh, darn it, I was going to furlough myself for 3 minutes.
Can I ask you a question about one of the other issues in the case? When Officer West comes into the campground, I think it's Officer West, or is it Deputy West?
The one that made the stop, Deputy West?
Yes. He had information that it was a Ford Ranger pickup truck, that the truck was driving around the campground. He stops a different kind of truck that is exiting the campground. Is the position that, any truck that you find in the campground can be stopped based on the telephone call that came in?
No, our position is, it's kind of a twofold position. First of all, if you look at Mascarenhas, there's several factors. And when you combine what the officer knew with the time of night and what it was late at night, there weren't likely to be many vehicles moving around anyway.
Well, we heard it was...
But aside from the suspects, and we knew the suspect vehicle was moving around, so there was the one vehicle we knew was moving, there was at least one he knew was moving, and there was one at the site that was moving. It was a small truck. Now, I think that if you consider the Mascarenhas factors together, that's enough to justify the stop. But there is this dispute about what he heard, namely what dispatch described. Okay, there was another deputy out there who testified at the suppression hearing that after the first dispatch involving a truck driving around, there was a second dispatch on the same frequency that Deputy West was on, and the dispatch said, wait, this truck, it's a mid-sized blue truck, and the guy is leaving the area. So there's the stop. Deputy West testifies at suppression, I stopped it because I thought it was a Ford Ranger. I think I remember hearing Ford Ranger, but dispatch might have said something else, might have said mid-sized blue truck. I don't remember. I'm going off my report. My report doesn't say mid-sized truck. It says Ford Ranger, but that could be wrong. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. What I'm getting at here is that the trial court actually made a finding that he stopped the truck because it was a blue mid-sized truck. That is consistent with Deputy Powers' testimony regarding all of the dispatches put together and Deputy West's admission that he didn't write everything he heard in his report and couldn't recall it. Now that I'm out of time, unless I can answer that question further, I will furlough myself back to my table.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Arvin, I'd like to follow up with the same question. Are you aware of any case where a defendant has asserted the choice of evils defense by driving intoxicated?
I'm not, Your Honor. I think it could be useful to compare the circumstances in this case to opinions where the choice of evils defense has been rejected, though, to see how far apart they stand. In People v. Fontes, for example, a defendant argued that he was justified in, I believe, forging a check because his children were hungry. In People v. Andrews, defendants argued that they were justified in obstructing a roadway because of a perceived threat of nuclear weapons. In People v. Brandyberry, defendant argued that he was justified in kidnapping person to deprogram her from what he perceived as a church, a cult-like church that she was a member of. I think here the facts that were before the court are far different than the facts in those cases, as they show an identifiable, tangible threat to Mr. Landon. He had already, the police officer stated that he had bite marks on his arm. He made a statement suggesting that he had been the victim of domestic violence. And moreover, his wife herself showed no red marks or swelling that would suggest that she had been hurt herself.
But the defendant would have to show with evidence during the offer of proof that there's nothing less. I couldn't have done anything less than what I did in the nuclear case and all the cases that you mentioned.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I suppose my point was, in those cases, the sort of evil that the defendants chose, the crime the defendants chose to avoid the purported evil, the distance between those two is quite frankly absurd in many of those cases, what they argued that the threat that they were trying to avoid was.
You weren't litigating them, I suppose.
Well, that's, I was not counsel on any of those cases. Here, this is a much different case. We have a case where the defendant has already suffered an injury. And I would further point out the state argued that Mr. Landon did not sufficiently purport to be threatened by an immediate injury. However, we have an injury that's already occurred to him, the bite marks that the police officer noted that were on his arm. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be deemed submitted. We thank counsel for their briefs and arguments, and a opinion will issue in due course. The court will be in recess, subject to call.